Speaking with Bernard Liotard and Jackie Dunn, authors of Rethinking Money, How New Currencies Turn Scarcity into Prosperity. Bernard, what's wrong with the way we think about money?
We have been trained to believe that you need to do everything with one single tool, that every country needs to have one currency, and that currency will do everything. We have been able to prove that actually that's not true. Number one, we're already in a world where multiple currencies are being used, business-to-business systems and other social purpose ones. And number two, the stability of the whole is actually enhanced by having a variety. This is not theory. Switzerland is well known to be a more stable country than its neighbors or in many other countries in the world, stable economically. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is that they've been using a dual currency system now for almost 80 years.
A dual currency system?
Yes.
What are the two different kinds of currencies?
Well, you have the Swiss franc, mm-hmm. which everybody knows. And you have a second currency called the WIR, W-I-R, which is a business-to-business currency. And it has been used since 1934. And a quarter of all businesses in Switzerland use it today.
What is a business-to-business currency?
It's a currency created by businesses when they transact with each other. When I sell you something, I have a credit, you have a debit. If you're doing something to me with equal value, that would be barter. However, if with my credit I can get something from Jackie and you can sell something to another business in town, we've created a currency between the four of us, haven't we?
I think what's really interesting here, Steve, is how this currency came about. It was way back in the dark days of 1934 in Switzerland, and 17 businessmen got a letter, all of them got a letter from their banks that morning saying, guess what, guys, your credit line has been stopped, as either cut or absolutely cut off completely. And they sat around with their heads in their hands and saying, good Lord, what are we going to do? And then they realized that they actually all transacted with one another. So rather than going to the bank as they had done traditionally and borrowing money from the local bank, they realized that as they were trading with one another, they could create their own internal currency. And this has kept business skyrocketing and doing extremely well in Switzerland for the last 80 years. And about 20% of all business is actually transacted in WIR.
So, but let me back up for a moment. What's wrong with just a single currency? It would seem like that's the easiest thing, and that's certainly what most of us are familiar with. I mean, in the United States, there is the almighty dollar. I mean, that would seem to be the money that determines everything. What's wrong with just using that?
It is more efficient. You're correct. It can process volume, but it is more fragile. It's more brittle. Let me explain why. But using the same example of the WIR in Switzerland, if you give a normal business, a Swiss business guy, the choice between 1,000 Swiss franc and 1,000 WIR, he will always take the Swiss francs, because mm-hmm. with that he can pay his taxes, with that he can take vacations in Mexico, and he can buy stuff from China. With the other one, he has to use the credits with 70,000 other businesses in the country. So, however, when you are in a boom period, and things are going very well, and everybody has Swiss francs, and my staff is fully employed, and you come and say, I want to buy something for 1,000 Swiss francs, I'll say, come back next month. On the other hand, if I were in the recession and everybody's credit has been cut, as is happening now, well, then I grab it. So that currency is counterbalancing systemically what happens in the conventional money. If such a system was available in America right now, don't you think there are lots of businesses that actually would like to trade with each other? You know, it's like having a spare tire. It's a stupid idea until you have a flat, right?
So you're not actually saying that there should be an alternative currency that replaces the current monetary system. You're saying there should be additional forms of currency.
Exactly. Other media of exchange than those created by bank debt, which is how dollars are created, and therefore have the capacity to adapt to circumstances of the conventional economy.
There's another way of looking at it. We're talking about having a monetary toolbox. The dollar is brilliant in what it does. And we call that like a hammer. It's great for hammering in a nail into a wall. However, if you want to paint a room, you can't paint it with a hammer. You need, obviously, a paintbrush. And what we're saying is also true with money. The dollar is brilliant, or the national currencies are brilliant. They were created 400 years ago in a time with a very different sensibility and a very different sets of needs. Today, we're in an information age, a very different age than the industrial age, and we need different currencies to actually address our problems.
And there actually are lots of different kinds of currencies, right? I mean, around the world. I mean, there aren't just a few alternative currencies.
Sure.
I mean, there are hundreds, if not thousands.
There are thousands. Let me start with one example that all your listeners are familiar with. Mm-hmm. Frequent flyer miles.
Okay.
They exist in 40 years. It's issued by someone else than a bank. It's not issued with as a debt, right? So, and there are two things that it has shown. Number one, it's possible to have very large-scale systems. There are 15,000 billion miles in circulation today. This is not a marginal little thing, at very low cost. If it was expensive, you needed an army of clerks to make this happen, it wouldn't happen. Second point, you can change behavior of people systemically for a long time. And that's extraordinarily important because we need behavior change now in our society.
And when you say you can change behavior, in what way has the frequent flyer system changed behavior?
Well, you tend to prefer to take the same airline, don't you?
Sure.
Before that, you didn't. And without it, you didn't. And if it wasn't working, they wouldn't do it, would they?
Okay. And you want to pay with that particular credit card so you can rack up your miles.
There we go. So in other words, it is working in terms of changing behavior. And what a currency does, a complementary currency of that type, is always linking an unused resource, i.e. an empty seat, with an unmet need, i.e. in this case, the need for the airline to get loyalty from you. Okay, so that is what it does. If the airline had to buy the seats at commercial rate, it wouldn't be interesting either. But just imagine there's a lot of unmet needs in the society and there's a lot of unused resources that are not captured.
So what are some other kinds of complementary currencies?
Maybe we can describe some stories about how ordinary people, by thinking outside of the box, actually created a solution, a monetary solution to their problems. I think one of my favorite stories, and it's about 25 years old, but it actually goes to the point because it's been so successful, is in Curitiba, Brazil. The mayor at that time had a huge problem of garbage, particularly in the favelas. And he did not have any money. I mean, there was nowhere to go for money. This sounds very, very familiar to us almost 3 decades later. So he did have a bus system that was running a lot of buses that were empty. So he sent out a notice to the favelas and saying to all the children in the favelas, for every bag of garbage they bring in that has been pre-sorted between like paper, cans and glass, they would get a bus ticket. A bus token. So lo and behold, within about 2-3 weeks, the favelas were picked clean of garbage. And you can imagine the problems with garbage between rats and diseases, etc. Then the kids had these tokens, which then enabled them and their families to use the bus service. And then local farmers started accepting these tokens in trade for vegetables and fruits that were grown locally.
Hmm. So they weren't just used to ride the buses.
Yes,
then.
They actually
became a currency.
Yeah, it actually became a currency. Hmm. The brilliant thing about this is Jaime Lerner, again an architect and a systems thinker, designed several other currencies. And within about 5 to 6 years, the average person who lived in Curitiba had a standard of living that was 1/3 higher than the average Brazilian living somewhere else. So it's not just this cute little idea. It actually showed up in the bottom line of everybody's paycheck.
You're saying that this all happened just because of the system of bus tokens?
That is what they credited to.
Huh.
Yes. Actually, it's an income that was derived from the buses. Okay, you can actually track it. Another thing that they did is the bus system today in Curitiba is world standard in terms of quality. People with cars in Curitiba don't bother to take the car. They prefer to take the bus because it's faster to get there and you don't have to park at the other end. Hmm. So there's some lessons there.
And also the UN gave the city of Curitiba, an award for being the most ecologically advanced city of any city in the world. I mean, they were able to really address the issue of how do we build an ecologically sustainable town.
How big a city is this?
Well, it must be between 3 and 4 million now.
Oh, so we're talking very big.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Well, it has grown big.
Yeah.
It started 25 years ago at about 1.7 million, but it has easily doubled.
So to talk about some other examples that I read about in your book, in Japan, there's a system of some sort of complementary currency for healthcare for the elderly,
right? Japan is a very interesting case, Steve, because they really hit the wall about 20 years ago about how to deal with the elderly. And again, you know, where did the government, how would the government come up with the money, you know, to pay for elderly care? So they came up with a system called Furiai Kipu, which takes care of the elderly beyond what they would get in terms of medical care. So how elderly people could actually remain in their homes for longer. So how it works is that I go down the road to my neighbor and I might help her shop, or I might drive her to the dentist or write a letter, whatever she needs. And for every hour that I spend helping her out, I get an electronic credit in my Furiai Kipu account. The beauty of this is I can use these electronic credits, say when I've got flu and I need somebody to pick up my kids, or I can, you know, save them for when I'm much older and actually need help in assisted living at my own home. Or, interestingly enough, I can transfer it to another part of Japan so somebody can come in and look after my mom. The beauty of this is the elderly that they surveyed love this, because people are young, usually younger folks are coming into their home and these intergenerational relationships are forming, something that we're having a problem in the developed world of this breakdown. We all seem to be siloed depending on our age. Furthermore, you know, they can stay in their homes longer, and this hasn't cost the government anything. There are now about 500 of these systems dotted, networked all through Japan with two central clearinghouses.
Wow. Tell me other examples.
Oh.
Where to start? I mean, there's about 50 different types of money.
I mean, what you're really saying is that if there's a need, there's a chance that you can come up with a different currency to somehow to meet that need.
Exactly. Just make the list of ideas that you will think are good ideas that aren't happening because there's no money for it.
Yeah. Well, and it makes me think that, I mean, just sort of on a much smaller scale, I mean, I know of people, for instance, who basically have a food sharing system. Mm-hmm. You know, I cook one day of the week and I make a bunch extra for other families. And then, you know, I get all these other meals, or a babysitting co-op. I mean, those are that's along the lines of what you're talking about.
Absolutely.
Right?
Like time banking is the most common system of complementary currencies or community currencies here in the United States. It was formed in about 1980 by Edgar Kahn, an attorney in Washington, D.C. There, as I said, about 400 systems throughout the country and are growing by 1 to 2 systems a week, and whereby I do something for an hour and it can look at everything from restorative justice. It can do be used in mentoring. I mean, there are just so many different applications. And the reason why, you know, people want to use time banking, it's a way of keeping track of the hours spent doing social purpose things. I mean, volunteerism is fantastic, but the burnout rate is so high. When I actually receive some kind of monetary compensation for what I'm doing, I think it incentivizes people, and it's a way of keeping control on the quality.
It also sounds like there is an honor system that's at work there. I mean, if you really wanted to cheat the system, you probably could.
Yes, but the system is transparent to its users. Okay, which is another feature that conventional money doesn't do, all right? I can see your account before I trade with you, exchange with you. So it's self-policing.
So in other words, if you claim that you've done a lot more work on behalf of others than you really have, that's going to catch up to you at some point.
It will catch up, and you have a bad reputation, and people won't deal with you anymore. It's self-policing.
It won't even catch up. It's, I mean, it's there for everybody to see that you're not telling the truth.
Well, maybe we need to back up for a moment and talk about what money is. I mean, it would seem to be obvious. It's a commodity that's exchanged for goods, but you're suggesting it's actually something else.
Yes. Well, let's start by saying what it is not. Every economic textbook claims that money is the three standards of medium of exchange, store of value, and unit of account, right? That's not what money is. That's what it does. It's the functions of money. Now, in fact, money is an agreement. It lives in the same space as marriage, as a political party, as a business deal. Okay? It's an agreement within a particular community to use something standardized as a medium of exchange. That's our definition. Now, from that perspective, it becomes possible to make all kinds of agreements. When you define it as a function, well, the first question is, well, we have it already. If nobody had, the word transport did not exist, say, and we only had horses, nobody would think about a bicycle or a car, would they? They would perfect horses forever.
Right.
So by defining it as an agreement, When you have an agreement, you can change the agreements. You can create new agreements. You can agreements with other people.
When you talk about agreement, you're really talking about a social contract.
Yes. It can be formal or informal. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't have to be. You don't have to sign with your blood and a piece of paper in order to participate. By the very fact of accepting that unit of account, you have actually made the agreement of accepting it as an exchange medium.
And you're also free not to accept it. The only reason why everybody runs after dollars is because we have to pay our taxes in it. And that makes it a preferential currency, something that people prefer to use. But generally, a community can come together and agree to use whatever they want as a standardized medium of exchange. Like we look at our American history, for example, tobacco leaves have been used as a medium of exchange. Stones, axes, I mean, you name it, has at some point somewhere in the world been used as a medium of exchange.
You mentioned taxes, which raises an interesting question. I mean, are all of these different currencies legal? And if you make a transaction, do you need to pay a tax?
The rules are very simple. You could use whatever you want in terms of medium of exchange, as long as you pay your taxes in U.S. dollars. That's the principle. There is one exception in America. The time banking system that Jackie mentioned earlier is officially been ruled tax exempt three times now by the IRS because it solves social problems that otherwise would cost a lot of taxpayer dollars. Hmm. So it's now tax exempt. But if you have the business-to-business system that we refer to, like the VIA, you pay your taxes on that in the currency that is officially accepted for doing that.
Is there also a philosophy in these different kinds of currencies? I mean, I think we tend to think of, you know, let's talk about the dollar, for instance, mm-hmm. as it's a very competitive system.
Exactly.
You know, there, and it's to some degree based on scarcity.
It is.
Are you sort of trying to bring it in a different philosophy as to how we think about money?
It's not just a philosophy. It actually is different functionality. And there's sort of two very fundamental thoughts. In all national currency, and all national currencies are the same, whether it's a euro, you know, a peso, or indeed the dollar.
They're created the same way.
They're created the same way, absolutely out of bank debt. And they have all have interest. Now, there's two thoughts here. One is that they all have to remain scarce because if they were in sufficiency, you know, there'd be hyperinflation. Furthermore, because of interest, they have different functional dynamics, which include the erosion of social capital, the concentration of wealth, short-termism, and I'm trying to remember the fourth
and
here.
Competition.
And competition, yeah.
When you pay the process by which dollars are created, which is through a bank loan, they create the principle out of nothing. Mm-hmm. But you have to go in the world and compete with others to pay the interest, to obtain the interest. When you pay back an interest on your loan, you're using someone else's principle.
So in other words, if I buy a house for $100,000 and take out a, I don't know, 20-year mortgage or something like that, you know, I'm really going to be paying $200,000.
Exactly.
And I add in all the extra interest, and that extra interest
is never created.
Is not created, except in the form of principle of other people. So we're all competing against each other. You had detected correctly that the conventional money is competitive. Mm-hmm. Actually, it's an extreme example. Go to a normal, healthy family, put $1 million on the table, come back 2 weeks later, everybody's fighting. You know, it's striking that, you know, how much competition is built into that particular currency.
So it sounds like what you're really trying to do is to show that there are other kinds of currencies that sidestep the banking system.
Exactly.
And to some degree, the banking system is tied into who has power in society.
Exactly. We're talking about democratizing money for the first time. And it is becoming possible because of the information age. We see this whole process of this emergence of complementary currencies as a sign of the information age.
What? Why? Because of the information age?
Well, let's go back with the freaking fly miles. If you needed an army of clerks in order to track them, do you think it would have happened? Hmm. No way.
Yeah.
All these 95% of all complementary currencies are electronic. A little normal computer that that you buy today for $1,000 has more than 10 times the capacity of the computer center that I was managing with 100 people at the central bank in Belgium. So
there are many more complementary currencies now than there were 30 years ago or
Absolutely.
So.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. Dramatically
yes.
so.
Yes. About, actually, in 1984, there were two social purpose ones. We're looking at the social purpose ones rather than just the commercial ones. And today there are more than 5,000 easily.
Is this something that's just sort of this whole system of complementary currencies? Are we talking about kind of dabbling around the edges of how we live? Or are you talking about something that could really be central to the way we conduct daily life?
It can change. It will change society. There are actually societies where have been traditionally been using dual currencies. One of them where we spent some time is Bali. They have 3,000 complementary currencies.
3,000 in one country?
In one island of 3 million people, plus the national money.
Right.
Okay, and this is traditional, going back to 845 AD, at least. Now, when the richest man in Bali died, he had not honored his community by not going to the meetings. He had replaced it with paying dollars, okay, with paying money, okay, which you can do. Well, nobody came to his burial. Because if you don't honor your social capital, you're not going back. Now, in a society where only one scoreboard, which is dollars, well, that won't happen. Okay? So we actually are losing democracy, losing social capital.
Losing community.
Losing community. We're all starving of community.
But what makes you think that this is going to catch on in a big way?
It's caught on. It's catching on. It's happening right in front of us. It's not like this is no longer theory. This is a happening thing all
over
the world.
But maybe this is just sort of these socially conscious people who want to do this with their friends.
I think the thing here is you bring up a very good point. The problem is America is behind the curve on this. Brazil is right out in front. The government is launching 200 dual currency banks in that country. 103 of them have already been launched. I mean, they're seeing that this is the way forward.
And it is a country that has, with China, reduced most poverty in the last 15 years. And that's the same time period when these systems were introduced. And that's why they're now generalizing it. Hmm. So the reason I think it's not of the just a fad. It first of all started before the crash.
Okay? Before the crash.
That has been happening, of 2007, 2008. Mm-hmm. It has started way before that. We have 4,000 systems that we identified before that crash. Okay. So, and they're now exploding to the point where we can't really count them. Okay. So it's not driven by the crisis, it's just accelerated by it. And the second point is this is part of the information age. There will be countries that will be staying behind, not using this technology, just like China refused the industrial age when they refused steel mills and railroads back in the 19th century. They became a developing country. Okay, you have that choice. Mm-hmm. There will be countries that will actually stick to the old gun of having a single currency. But I think they're going to be the developing countries of the 21st century. And I don't think America is going to be part of that. They're too clever. When something works somewhere else, they will go and hang after it. And it's happening already.
Yes, you actually in Africa have a situation that you have people with mobile phones that have a purse on their mobile phones that has several different currencies, you know, several national and several complementary. You could have a learning currency. They could have an elderly care currency. They could have a local currency. I mean, it's incredible what technology can actually afford at this time.
What would a learning currency be?
I think one of the most wonderful stories actually you have, Bernard, about Brazil.
Well, I prefer the one in Lithuania.
Oh, yes, that is true, yes. No, Bernard is so involved all over the world in designing these things, I can't keep up.
what's happening in Lithuania?
Lithuania, you have the president of the country, who happens to be a lady, who has decided that she wants Lithuania to become a learning country. And what we're introducing is a learning process, a learning foundation. It's called the DORA, a unit of account. And anybody who is teaching something and who's learning something, the two parties receive DORAs, which is 1 hour of learning or teaching. Now, you can make a contract with the foundation to realize your dream, to realize your bucket.
Mm-hmm. Your bucket list.
Your bucket list.
Okay. I had one 16-year-old whose dream is to go to Burma to learn Vipassana Buddhism. Okay, and he speaks fluent English, so he will be teaching English to other people. And when he earns enough DORAs that he had agreed with, I think they will realize his dream. At the end of it, I asked him, look, by the way, your English is impeccable, which is rare there because Russian and Polish are the two secondary languages. You could actually earn a lot of litas, national money there. He said, no. I don't want the euros or the litas or the dollars. That only buys my airline ticket. I want something that realizes my dream. You can create a superior currency, motivating people to do things they would never do. You know, 3,000 hours of teaching English was what he was willing to commit to. Okay.
I think if I can have a little adjunct to that story is that all the children that participate in this, say under the age of, over the age of 12, are asked to teach older people like me, internet skills, social media, etc., because they really want everybody to be proficient and have long life for the length of their lives to have continual learning. Kids that are under the age of 12 are actually invited to go find an elderly person in their community and ask them this profound question. What is it in your life that you have learned that would benefit me to know? And that dialogue, intergenerational dialogue, happens, and both the person imparting their wisdom and the person listening to it, that's either writing an essay or making a film or whatever they're doing with the information, they all earn doras. But it's a beautiful way to pass on a wisdom from one generation to the next.
You know, one of the things I find fascinating about this whole story, Bernard, and I'm going to turn to you, is your background. I mean, given your resume, you were a major player in the National Bank of Belgium. You were one of the designers of the single currency system in Europe, what became the euro.
Yes.
You would seem to be the epitome of the power elite that that you're now criticizing.
Well, to understand that, it's very simple. The reason I had accepted a job at the central bank was because I had detected a systemic flaw in the monetary system, and I was hoping to correct it. And I actually left the central bank when I was told by the Bank of International Settlements with the Secretary General during lunch that I was in the wrong place. He said, Bernard, you don't understand. We, the Bank of International Settlements, which is the club of the central banks, every central bank in the world, the IMF and the World Bank, only exist for one purpose: to keep the system going exactly as it is, not to improve it. And he added, there will be changes in the monetary system because you're right, there are systemic flaws, but they will not be taken through the banking system at any level. So I resigned and do what I do now.
But, I mean, is the euro, the system that you helped create, is that part of the problem that you're describing?
Not really. I mean, I had been trying at the time to actually introduce systemic changes. I think we need the euro. If the euro did not exist, the European Union would have fallen apart.
Well,
back
it
in
might still then, because the
it
euro
may still,
is in
it
a
may
lot
still.
Of trouble right
there
now.
There have been flaws in political flaws, actually, in the design of the European Central Bank and in the responsibility for leaving the countries responsible for the banking system. When you set up a supranational system. Just imagine in America to have the Fed only active in each state, but you have banks working across the nation. That's not good. Okay, mm-hmm. So these are issues that, to be honest, I wasn't involved. This happened after I left. I was in charge of the convergence system, getting the 12 currencies to become one. And it's the first time that we succeeded actually doing that without a war. Okay. So it may sound strange, but no, actually, I'm still following the same trend. I believe that there is things that we need to change in the way we deal with money. We need to rethink money. And the possibility of doing it is there now. And with the challenges we have to face on this planet during the 21st century, we cannot address it with the tool set of the 17th century or the 18th century.
So you're saying that, I mean, the kind of financial disaster that we've seen over the last decade, well, really since 2007, I mean, you're saying that we'll see more of that.
Oh.
And the only way that we can deal with that is if we have these different systems of these different currencies?
The IMF, according to their own statistics, show there's been 425 systemic crashes in the last 30 years.
40 years.
40 years, thank you.
Since 1970.
The last 40 years. I mean, that includes, you know, bank crises, which we experienced here in the United States in 2007, 2008. There's been monetary crashes where the actual money system itself, you know, tanked. We're talking about Argentina, for example, talking about the ruble. And we're talking about sovereign debt crisis, as we are experiencing here in looking at Greece, for example. This is cyclical. You know, you can anticipate the 426 coming around the corner. there is a trend here.
Greece is 426, actually, in the sense that the statistics go from 1970 to 2010. Mm.
Yeah.
So the ones that have been happening since then, like Greece, are not even part of that statistic. So we can predict that there will be more of them.
Well, okay, let's play this out a little bit. So, you know, we had this devastating financial crisis in 2007, 2008. Are you saying that these kinds of alternative currencies could somehow stem the impact of that kind of crisis?
They would not necessarily avoid the problem of the system itself, but it would be a buffer, a shock breaker for the applications of it. If you had a currency system like we talked about in Switzerland, the Weir system, well, it can catch up. The volume will increase while the banking system deleverages as it's doing now. Okay, you can actually have other tools. It's back to the idea of a spare tire. Spare tire looks like a funny idea until you need it on a Saturday night in the middle of the highway, don't you? Then it becomes kind of vital. And yes, we can break the shocks. Similarly, for the social aspects, the aging of society has huge implications in terms of the quality of life of people. And if you try to address these issues with dollars, it won't work. It's just not possible. So you're going to have to either sacrifice that generation or invent new tools. And the Japanese already did. So in other words, the countries that are meeting these problems first are also the ones that are taking initiative in innovating.
So then the question is, who needs to invent these tools? I mean, is this...
People.
People rather than governments.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, actually, you can have applications at different levels. You can have, we've been talking about mostly now here of social purpose systems, which are people to people, right? They're business to business systems. So business networks, supply chains can set up their systems doing that. We claim that we need a global currency that's nobody's national currency in order to basically stabilize the global economy, okay? So there are different players at their different scale can each play their role. The metaphor, and it's more than a metaphor actually, is a monetary ecosystem. In an ecosystem, you don't have just elephants. You have a world on the scale of an elephant, of buffaloes, of mice, and of microbes. And all of them have a role. And it's the health of all these systems that actually stabilizes the system.
Or the analogy I was thinking of was the food system. You know, you don't want to have just one crop. You don't want to have a monoculture because, you know,
you have a blight and you're toast.
You're finished.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes, that's exactly the... But it is actually more than a metaphor. Huh? We have four peer-reviewed journals, publications, demonstrating scientifically that any monoculture of currencies will always remain unstable. Okay, so it doesn't even matter who manages it. Okay, you can improve the frequency of crashes, you can reduce it, but you cannot get rid of it. We haven't gotten rid of it for 400 years. This is not the last episode. Okay, and it's not the first one for sure either. But the media tend to reflect only the crisis as being the last one, and forget all the previous ones. I think it's time to look what's common to all of them.
Now, if we're really going to think outside the box, I know there are some people who would say that part of the problem with the way we think about economics is growth. I mean, it's of course the mantra that we have to grow. Society has to grow. Without that, the economy crumbles. There are people out there who say, actually, what we really need is a no-growth society. I mean, if we really care about sustainability, given the finite resources out there, what do you think?
That it is impossible to have no growth if you're using a currency created with interest. Because, as we explained earlier, the money is created, but the interest is not created until someone else has made the loan. So if you don't have new loans, nobody will have the money to pay their interest, and the whole thing system will collapse. So there is actually no option within the current monetary system to have a steady state economy at whatever level of satisfaction you want to drive it. We are running against a current systemically. And we can reduce such an impact by having an ecosystem of currencies where people can do other things that, we can evolve towards a society that actually fits our values and our needs for the 21st century, rather than getting stuck with the absolute model of the industrial age, which has been working for us for 300 years. I mean, I'm not against what it did in the past. Okay, it has created some problems that we now are facing, but it has done something good as well. It has made us wealthier materially than any previous generation. Now it's time, however, to have a system that actually fits our requirements for the 21st century. This is not a time period where we need more growth, where we need empires, where we need, you know, expansion. The planet is finite, and we're reaching some limits in it. So let's manage this process in a way that's democratic, that is flexible, that is fair, that actually works. And we have the tools. We're just being serviced with a fantastic set of tools in the information age that never could have existed before.
So you both sound optimistic. Because, I mean, the reason I say that is, I mean, I look around with people I know, and, I mean, there is a lot of gloom now.
Of course.
I mean, most people's wages are stagnant.
Yes.
We're still trying to climb out of this very deep recession. I have children who are about to enter the college ages. I don't have a clue how I'm going to pay for that. It sounds like you're saying maybe things aren't quite so bleak.
Not maybe. They aren't so bleak. We are just so excited by listening to all the stories from all around the world of ordinary people, you know, thinking outside of the box and coming up with extraordinary solutions by rethinking money. Everything from, you know, Bernard talked about the DORA land, but there, you know, you can use complementary currencies to have people mentor. There's no end to the possibilities. And who better to create a solution, a monetary solution, than the people facing the problem? And all that information is there on the internet. I think that's the extraordinary thing about it. You can download YouTube videos. I mean, software is available in open source. I mean, you've got all kinds of testimonials. I mean, it is truly exciting. And what we're looking forward to is seeing in 5 years' time, you know, what other people are continually coming up with as a solution. I think we will be totally marveled, and the hope that's involved in that.
And it can solve real problems like jobs. Jobs equal small and medium-sized businesses. They are all dying like flies right now. There are systems that have been proven to work in Brazil, in Uruguay, and Switzerland that are available.
Yeah, like
we could start tomorrow.
Yeah, like politicians saying, oh, gee whiz, how do we get an employer to come into our town with 5,000 new jobs? What we're saying and what we're hearing other people saying is, how do we get 5,000 local businesses employ another person? That is much more sustainable, much more realistic.
And a tool is available.
It's all very exciting. Thank you.
Good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. This was fun.